In August 1949, friends of Mimi Boomhauer arrive at Mimi's home to find that despite the lights on inside and outside her Bel Air mansion and her car in the garage, the wealthy widow is nowhere to be found. 7 days later, her purse is found inside a grocery store telephone booth with a cryptic message written and penned on its side, sending police into a flurry as they work to find her. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
This week, we are joined by Amber Dawn Fox.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, this episode sent me on so many side quests in my research.
Those are my favorite, though.
Like, only like 2% of it was necessary, but like...
Are we going to get to go on some of those side quests with you?
You definitely are, because I have pages and pages and pages of notes. I think, actually, I have the most notes on this episode than any of our episodes.
Really?
Yes, and I'm going to try to pack in as much of it as possible.
Okay.
Mostly because, as you know, I do like to show off all the random
things. Well, so we do like the random things because they do kind of lighten up sometimes. Are these going to be lightening up? We talk about heavy things, so that's why I think I like these little side stories so much, because they usually lighten the feeling a little bit.
Well, so this episode kind of hits some niches. It's like 1949 disappearance. It also just touches on like some ongoing mysteries that are not even about the disappearance that I was basically trying to solve in my office, in my house, by myself. And I came to zero conclusions. So maybe our listeners.
Maybe it's like a listener project.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. But first, we're going to start off this episode a little bit differently. So, Vanessa, picture this.
Okay.
It's April 1968 in Los Angeles, California, which is not a particularly scary time of the year. But then again, we do know that scary things can happen at any time, right?
Some of the scariest.
Yes. That's when an invitation arrives in the mail. You're to be a guest at a party held at a creaky, abandoned house up in the hills of Bel Air.
In the spring. I would go. Would you go?
Absolutely.
Of course we'd go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you, though, have heard of this house before. It's made the papers over the years. Recently, the Los Angeles Times has run an article about the scariest houses in the city, and this is one of them.
I'm there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've done that in our own town.
Yes.
Yes. Right?
They say the home is haunted by an independent filmmaker.
Okay, my people.
It is LA. And you are an independent filmmaker. His name is Tom Garrison.
Okay.
Back when he was alive, of course, Tom had purchased the Spanish-style home a few years ago and was working to restore it.
Okay.
He'd removed the wall-to-wall blue carpeting that someone had installed, revealing the 1930s tile beneath.
Good move.
They say he was in the shower one night when the phone rang.
Aw.
He went to answer it, but he slipped on the very tiles he was working to restore, falling down the stairs to his death.
Do you know that wet feet on tile is one of my fears? Like slipping on wet floors, because most of the time when you're doing that, you're naked.
Yes, I'm guessing since he was in the shower.
He might have been.
Yes. Sorry, Tom.
Sorry.
Some, though, say that he was pushed by the vengeful spirit of a woman named Mimi, who went missing from the home nearly 20 years ago. Her body was never found, but some believe that she is still there haunting its halls, and some believe she is still there physically, her body buried in the basement. For a while, realtors couldn't sell the home. Everyone they brought there to see it left with one opinion, that it's too spooky to buy.
So is Mimi the only ghost in the house now, or is Tom now considered ghost?
Well, they believe it's haunted by both.
By both, okay.
Mimi and Tom.
Okay.
So no one wants to buy it. That is until your friends, Margie and Dawn, bought it to live in with their four boys. You think it's strange that you're invited to a party, even though, you know, Margie, Dawn, and the boys haven't moved in yet. But it seems like a good opportunity to prowl around this house, which is one of the most exclusive in one of the most exclusive neighborhoods in LA.
Okay, you told me the backstory, but I'm still going.
You're still going.
I'm still going. Okay. Are you still going?
I mean, don't be wet.
Right. Wear your shoes.
Wear your shoes.
Hold the railing.
Yes.
Look over your shoulder.
Right. When you arrive, though, you're not alone. It looks like Margie and Dawn have invited everyone they know. I guess your invite wasn't so special after all. And like the rest of the guests, you're handed three things. A drink, a hammer, and a pencil.
Okay.
And you gather together items in hand and you're given instructions. Using the hammers, you're welcome to hammer down the walls to see if there's anything inside.
Yikes.
On the walls that remain, you're instructed to write messages to the departed, both Mimi and Tom.
This is a weird party, but I'm still going. I don't know if I could do it, though, the hammer part.
Oh, but you do.
But I do?
You're wandering through this hilltop mansion. And you're tap, tap, tapping with your little hammer.
Okay.
Lightly at first, of course, because
it's not my house, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But as you grab another drink, your swings become wilder and you're knocking hole after hole in the walls. By 2 a.m., there is not much left to destroy.
Because of all the drunken guests?
Right.
Okay.
Holes are everywhere. Plaster is littering the floors. And you can make out a few messages other guests have written, like, Kilroy was here. And, Mimi, where are you? And, Mimi must be here. A few guests did have a laugh when they found a skeleton Margie and Dawn had hidden in a closet. But other than that, there don't seem to be any skeletons hiding in the walls or ghostly presences brushing past you. But when you gather again, there's another person there, a spiritualist who holds forth from her podium a coffin she set up as she describes her next plan. You all soon form a conga line, the spiritualist in front holding a bell and incense and reciting incantations, hoping to summon the spirits of Mimi and Tom as you walk from room to room. See, the party got pretty good.
I'm starting to really just be jealous that this isn't real.
Yeah.
For me.
For you.
Like, it was real for these guests who probably look back on this as possibly the weirdest party they've ever been to.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the summoning doesn't work. So as the sun rises, you still haven't experienced anything supernatural. The only mystery is a walk-in safe that's found, the combination of which the spiritualist cannot divine.
Mm.
Well, your friend Margie says, the one thing we can be sure of is there are no termites here. If there were, they'd be dead of shock by now.
What?
You would have, like, scared the termites.
Scaring the termites to death.
But as you head home, leaving Margie and her family at the home they plan to renovate, you can't help but think, better them than me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who would want to deal with the mess?
I don't know who would want to deal with the mess. I think Margie sounds kind of cool.
Like, yeah.
A little bit crazy.
Uh-huh.
But, like, a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And she's definitely a risk taker.
Yeah. So this, again, is a real party that happened.
Did they end up renovating it for real and moving into that house?
They did, yeah. So the Beckett family, they did take possession of the house on Nimes, I believe it's pronounced, Road in Bel Air.
Okay.
Now, Nimes Road is now home to the ultra rich. Residents of this neighborhood have included Elizabeth Taylor and Nancy Sinatra. In fact, they both lived in the house across the road from this one. And one of the Murdochs, I think, currently lives in the neighborhood. So
those Murdochs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know which son it is. The, like, most important one or the semi-important, like, I don't know. One of them. And while there was difficulty selling this home in 1968 for a price tag of $175,000, this home sold in 2023 for nearly $37 million. In fact, you can see this home today on an episode of Buying Hollywood on Netflix.
Really? And is it the owners from it's the 2023 episode of that then? Like when it sold?
So, yeah.
But did they buy it from The family that had the party?
I think it has gone through
a It has gone through several from them. Okay. I'm just wondering, because, like, feels like the more haunted the house would be, like, the more owners there'd be.
Yeah. So I took it upon myself to watch TV for this episode. So I did
That you had to do that.
I watched this episode. It's clearly been renovated since, like, it's very beautiful.
Did they talk about, like, the two ghosts and the party? No.
But that's like the most interesting
part of it.
So none of its history is in this episode. And I was like,
that's
so fascinating. Yeah. I am a bit concerned for it, though, because, like, what happened to a lot of the homes in this area is, like, they were torn down. And so I did see some renderings of some proposals of how this house could look if it was drastically renovated or torn down.
Okay.
So I have some concerns, but it is still itself, right? Now, this home was built by the Mimi I mentioned in the beginning.
Ghost
Mimi. But this was built by Mimi Boomhauer, is her name, and her husband, Novice.
That's amazing. Do you not like that name?
Well, it's just like, I was like,
but it sounds like you never, like, advance in life. You're just always a novice.
Okay, so they built this house in 1931, right? Mm-hmm. Now, most of the houses in this neighborhood do not have that type of provenance anymore. They're more recent, but they started construction in August and had hoped to move in during early fall. So that's like really speedy construction. Though they'd been primarily living on the East Coast, they had hoped to make LA home. Now, once Mimi and Novice moved in, they fully inserted themselves into the Southern California social life. At the time, Novice was 45 and Mimi was 26, an age gap for certain, but the couple got along well together. They hosted party after party at their Nimes Road residence, and the papers said these could not be missed, these parties. So, long history of party having, particularly if you wanted to get a glimpse of their big game room. So, not board games.
Big game.
Big game. The room was outfitted with their private collection of big game that they were said to have hunted across the world in places like Africa, China, and South America. Guests could wander among lions, tigers, zebras, gorilla, and even an African elephant head with tusks 7 feet long. I've seen some photos of this room.
Sounds crowded.
It is packed.
Is it packed?
It is.
That sounds like, because just the size of some of these. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big house now. It was a big house at the time, but like that room is just like, yikes. A little overwhelming. To those who met them, Novice was a big game hunter and an inventor, inventing a type of linoleum product called Congolium. And Mimi was his young wife, short and somewhat stocky. She was always ready for an adventure and laughed and told stories in the most delightful French accent. And this is where things get a bit sticky. Because obviously from the opening story, you know Mimi will at some point go missing. And the circumstances are unsettling at best. Mimi is believed to be quite wealthy at the time of her disappearance in 1949. But later, friends and family will start to realize that she was actually in financial distress. This is information that was kept hidden from her friends, but later released in the papers. So it's clear that there was a public Mimi and a private Mimi.
Okay.
But also, thanks to historic documents that I dived into extensively, of course, I can say that Mimi and Novice lied about a few other things. And this is, I don't know how well documented this is. So at least in storytelling about Mimi.
Like how
Mimi.
Accurate?
Well, no. So like these.
Yeah, oh, so it is accurate, but it's not documented.
Well, okay. So it's documented in all of these records. But when Mimi's story is told, like, this definitely isn't included. So I hope this is some original reporting here.
Okay.
So these were not revealed at the time of her disappearance because these documents are much more readily accessible now than they were in 1949. So, you know, ship manifests and census records and all of those things. Okay. And the thing is, I actually don't know if these add up to anything or not, since I'm really just like presenting information, but maybe this might help someone else as we get like a fuller picture of who these two were.
Okay.
And I do think we kind of have to understand both of them together. So I'm actually going to talk a little bit about Novice first. Okay, so digging in.
Sure.
Novice is the older of the couple, and he was born in Gallupville, New York.
Okay.
In 1878 to Frank Boomhauer and Hattie Hempstead.
Okay.
Now, his father is an apiarist in Schoharie County, New York, and he and his younger brothers grow up tending to the bees.
Is that what that means?
Yep, they're beekeepers.
Beekeepers, okay.
Yeah. Now, Novice is known as one of the lightning operators, kind of famed for how quickly he can go through an extracting yard to collect the buckwheat honey they produced.
Sounds kind of cute.
It is so cute.
It's like the family business making buckwheat honey.
Yeah. It's because like all the fields in Schoharie County were like buckwheat at the time.
Okay. So
that's the kind of honey.
I have never heard of Gallupville, New York, though.
Yeah, Schoharie County.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'd heard of it before?
I had not. So it's not that big.
Oh, it's not big? It's not big enough to hear about? Okay.
No. But so it's in that kind of central New York region.
Okay.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in 1895, Emily Shmilichek is born in New York City to Bohemian immigrants Joseph Shmilichek Lujan and Emily Rezek. Before we did mention Bohemia before in our episode on Bessie Kutnik. So, but it is now reductively speaking the Czech Republic. I do realize mm-hmm. it's much more complicated history. But so Emily, or Mimi, as she will later be called, was not born in France, nor is she French. Her only France connection is that much later her younger brother starts living in Paris.
So the accent?
She was, I don't know, she's born in New York City to like...
Is she making up the accent?
I
you said
still I think maybe, French honestly. Accent. I think she does. Oh. At first, okay, I'll get there. So Mimi was one of several children, and her siblings were Olga, which honestly was the first clue I had in guessing that Mimi might not be French.
Right.
Like, Olga doesn't really seem French.
No.
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 Her other siblings were Josephine, Bertha, and Joseph. And their father, Joseph Sr., was a physician who at times worked for the U.S. Department of Health. The family lived very comfortably on East 72nd Street in New York City. So wealthy enough to, at times, be able to afford live-in staff.
Okay.
Okay. So, and while Mimi's going to school, Novice, who she hasn't met yet, is, because they are indeed, like, he's 17-year mm-hmm. age gap between them, he's making his way in life. At some point, he left the beekeeping life and worked as a traveling salesman before meeting and marrying a woman named Daisy Ringwalt in Ohio in 1902.
Okay.
So the couple soon moved to New York City, residing on 2020 Broadway in New York City. Novice begins a rug business with his brother Arthur, and the two seem to be doing pretty well before Novice built his own company named after himself and eventually becomes the president of W.A.W. Davis Corporation, which is a business that dealt with floor coverings of various sorts.
Okay. So is he doing pretty well for himself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So by the time World War I happens, the Boomhauers, meaning at this point, Daisy and Novice, seem to be doing, quite well. And Novice donates his newly built pleasure power yacht. Like, that is what they called it in the article, a pleasure power yacht.
Okay.
To the cause. And the vessel's called the Uzona. It actually gets donated back to him later, but it's called at the time the Uzona. Okay. And it features three master bedrooms, was finished in solid mahogany, and its decks were covered in Beaux-Art rugs. Beaux-Art is actually one of the additional companies that Novice was handling at the time, along with Ringwalt linoleum and new craft floor coverings.
Okay.
Yes.
He's got all kinds of stuff going on. He even named one after his wife.
Well, yeah. So I'm actually wondering, I did not dive too much into like Daisy's life. So I was like, was that like from her family or did he name it after her?
Right.
I don't know. Okay. So to be clear, I could not find any patents in Novice's name to back up the claim that he invented any products and Congolium, the specific product he's later credited with creating, existed for many years before Novice was even born.
So he is not the inventor.
He is not an inventor of Congolium,
which I have not heard of. But
so. Yeah, it's basically like a linoleum. Don't come for me, Congolium. creators, because it still exists today. It's like a, like in the realm of linoleum products.
Okay.
Okay. Which, as I know from renovating my house, which was built in 1895, yes, linoleum was a thing back then. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping to find gorgeous wood floors. And then I took up the carpeting and it was...
gorgeous linoleum.
It was original linoleum.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. But I know linoleum, but I just don't know congoleum.
Yeah, so yeah. Congoleum. Okay. So, which is to say he was making his money from flooring, but it's unlikely that he was inventing floor coverings from what I can tell.
Okay.
Now, during World War I, Daisy, who is, to be clear, a wealthier white woman, did something unusual, and she just took off for France to work for the Red Cross. And she spent close to a year in Paris with the Red Cross.
Okay.
I'm not sure if novice ever serves. It's really unclear to me when Daisy and novice decide to go their separate ways, but like we know the couple was together in 1920 through 1921. And at this time, flashing back to Mimi, she's living with her family in New York City, though she does have a professional job in dentistry.
Okay.
By 1928, though, Novice and Mimi are listed together for what I think is the first time on a ship's manifest sailing from San Francisco to Honolulu. Now, you
did
might
they
be,
meet on the boat? Or
is I there a... cannot pinpoint when they met.
Mm-hmm.
To me, kind of going to like Hawaii seems like maybe a honeymoon trip.
Okay.
But I can't find, I have not spotted their marriage record yet.
So you think they might have been married on this?
Well, I can't find their marriage record at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did they meet on this? Was this their honeymoon? Were they already married for?
Yeah. Are they legally married?
What's happening?
Know. Okay.
Okay.
So I don't know when that all started, but we do know she's going by the Boomhauer last name in 1928.
Okay. So they are going as like a married couple.
Yes. Now, in 1928, before this couple makes this trip, Novice takes a trip on his own. And that manifest lists his birth year as 1879 instead of 1878. So that's a slight discrepancy. And you might be thinking, no big deal. Maybe it's typo, right?
Maybe. But maybe. But these two, I mean, he's not inventing things. She's not from France.
Yeah. Like, what more
like, is there? I don't know.
Okay. But on his trip with Mimi a few months later, she lists her date of birth as 1897. Okay. Making her 2 years younger than she actually is. And he lists his as 1886, making him 8 years younger than his actual age.
Okay, I can see him wanting to be younger because of their age difference, but why is she wanting to be younger too?
I don't know. I can't tell if this is...
Why are like, we doing this?
I can't tell if it's like a vanity thing or if there's something like suspicious going on, but...
Okay.
And this change of age, this happens often with the two of them. The following year, they arrive in New York on another ship, and he's changed his birth year to 1883, making him 45 instead of his real age of 51. And she's changed her age to 1902, which makes her 26 instead of her actual age, which is 34.
Okay. Jeez. So are they 45 and 26? Because that's what you told me at the beginning of this. And now I'm like, wait, what?
How old are they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, like, it feels like we've been discussing this too long. But I think there's, like, some oddities here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they kind of settle on some ages, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, but both of them are much older than what they're saying.
So do they actually have 17 years apart?
So, yes.
So, that's the only thing that's true.
Well, we do know that he was born in 1878. She was born in 1895.
Okay. So, that part.
Yes. Okay. But they change them often.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, when Novice passes away after a prolonged illness, he passes away at 11:45 on August 17th, 1943, in their home on Nimes Road. The papers said that he was 59 years old, which is actually 6 years younger than he actually was.
Mm.
And if you're wondering how he died, which I was, because I swear I went on every journey possible, mm-hmm. It was a cerebral hemorrhage caused by cerebral arteriosclerosis. Okay. So this leaves Mimi largely alone in their big mansion on the hill. And to fill the absence of her husband in her life, Mimi kept up their social schedule. So she's packing her evenings, certainly not days, because apparently Mimi loathed getting up early, with parties and events. And while her friends didn't believe that she had any romantic interests after Novice's death, she did have two gentlemen friends who would escort her to events. On August 18th, 1949, the day after the sixth anniversary of Novice's death, Mimi visited a few shops before heading back to her home. At some point during the day, she told her business manager, Carl, which, by the way, her friends and family didn't know Carl existed, but he does. She told her business manager, Carl, that she was going to meet with a man that evening, but didn't specify where or why.
Okay, so her business manager. What business?
Well, yeah.
What's her business? Oh, good there. Okay, good there. Am I getting ahead again?
You are. You are.
Okay.
Okay. So at some point that evening, Mimi changed clothing. She left a dress on her bed. And at 7 p.m., she had a phone conversation with her friend, Stella. Now, Stella and Mimi were supposed to have dinner the night before, like the anniversary of Novice's death.
Okay.
Right, on the Wednesday. But Mimi had phoned her the day before to reschedule it to a Wednesday luncheon before calling back again and just like canceling it altogether. She just basically said some things had come up.
Okay.
As possibly an apology, Mimi did send Stella a bowl of white flowers with a note which read, "I'll be thinking of you." Okay. But on that Thursday, the two talked for an hour. They were talking about their plans for an out-of-town party the two planned to go to with two male friends. Both women were widows, and these men would, like, escort them to a party at the Susie Q Ranch. Okay. And they were going to do this on Sunday. So it's Thursday. This is their plan for Sunday.
Okay.
Stella said Mimi sounded cheerful during their call and didn't seem in a hurry to get off. And Stella was under the impression that Mimi planned to stay in that evening. They ended the call around 8 p.m. Stella was the last person to talk to Mimi. On Friday morning, Stella tried reaching Mimi by phone in the morning, but she didn't get an answer. And Stella was surprised because, as I said, Mimi was not really a morning person, and she was not in the habit of being out of the house in the morning.
So this is really unusual.
Yes, they're like, something's up.
Okay.
Okay, so she calls Friday morning. That Friday evening, Fred McCulloch was supposed to meet Mimi for dinner. The two had met at a party several months before, and they often went out together socially. He's one of the two.
The gentleman callers,
right. He said that he waited for her, but she never arrived. So he drove to her home at around 10 p.m. and said when he got there, all of her lights were on. More than usual, like the light on her patio, one on her porch, one near the garage, all were on, indicating that she planned to return in the dark. And her car, though, was still in the garage and all the doors were locked.
Now she lives entirely alone.
Yes.
Does she have like housekeepers or anybody that's
in? No.
So she's alone and she has no help.
Right.
Okay.
Yes. She's in this big mansion just rattling around by herself.
Okay.
Okay. So he goes, she's not there. Saturday, because he waits, because he's like, maybe, I don't know, something's going on. But Saturday he waits and he calls Stella. He says, like, this is what I found, right? And so Stella's like, I haven't heard from her either. And so alarmed, like, the two finally decide to call the police, right? Now, unbeknownst to them, her business manager, who no one knows exists, Carl, had also been by her home. Carl had actually been trying to help Mimi sell that big game collection.
Okay, so Carl's a real person.
Yes.
Okay.
It's just they didn't know she had this business manager guy. Okay, so he's trying to help them sell this big game collection. But he was actually supposed to talk to her on Friday. Now, some reports say they were supposed to have a scheduled call on Thursday, but it's Friday. That basically Mimi had some film reels that she and Novice had taken on their African safaris, and like they were trying to sell those to some studios.
Okay.
And so they were supposed to have a conversation about it on Friday, but she didn't call him. And so he went by her house, and I think on Sunday, and he found it just as Fred had, but like this time there were packages building up outside her door from purchases that she had made the day of her disappearance. Okay. August 18th.
So she's trying to sell the big game collection and she's trying to sell these film reels. Yes. And she's just not home and now there's packages piling up.
Yes. We'll be back in a moment. So, to get permission to enter, the police have to call Mimi's sister, Olga, who lived in Long Island. And when police finally enter the home, they found little amiss. Like, everything seems to be in order. There are no signs of a struggle. The car is, yes, in the garage. The refrigerator was full of groceries. There are reports from years later that Mimi's salad was on the table, as though she disappeared before she could eat it. But in my investigation of the initial reports, this isn't mentioned. Stella did say when she entered the home with the police, it was in perfect order, and there wasn't even a glass touched on her bar. Now, the only thing missing was her jewelry that she often wore and a Persian lamb cape.
Could she be wearing the jewelry, though?
Yeah, so she went everywhere with this jewelry.
Yeah.
Now, police began searching for her immediately, but there's little to go on. No one has seen her, and it's unclear where she would have gone without her car. They do contact taxi companies, but none reported picking her up.
Did they contact the other boyfriend?
Yeah, they talked to everyone. Right. So police assign countless men to search for Mimi, and the news of her disappearance soon makes the papers across the country. It's been covered in our local paper here. Yeah. And tips flood in. At one point, a man comes into the station, unfurls a map, and then holds up a string with a plum attached to the end of it. And then he kind of holds the string and swirls the plum over the map until the plum finally falls off the string and lands on the Dakota Badlands. And the man's like,
"What?
That's where she'll be found."
Like an actual...
I don't know.
Okay, so we don't know what the plum thing is.
No.
There's like a swirly thing.
A swirly thing. It's called
a plum with a B, but this one's a plum with no B.
Yeah.
So this might be a fruit.
Is it a fruit or is it the...
Or is it the thing? If somebody knows if plums, the fruit, are used in divining.
Yeah.
Let us know.
In the papers, it was reported without the B.
Like, but also it fell off the...
It fell off the string. It fell off
the string, so that sounds like a fruit.
I don't know. But basically, Mimi was not...
Was she in... No.
In the Badlands.
No.
As far as investigators could ascertain, nor was she anywhere else they looked.
Yeah, because I think the plum thing is inaccurate.
Yeah, no. Yeah. So it's like, you know, as they will later say about her, that Mimi vanished into thin air. Now, the first solid physical clue in Mimi's case won't come until 1 week later when Mimi's purse is found in a telephone booth at Ralph's, which is a grocery store located at 9331 Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills. The purse, which some people called a calfskin purse and some a semi-cloth purse, was reported to be one of Mimi's favorites. It was found by a 40-year-old meat cutter named Walter Cheney. Neither Cheney nor the employees knew how this purse ended up in this phone booth. The purse contained no money, but did have Mimi's car keys, a compact, and her ID cards inside. The real piece of interest was that on the outside, though, there's something written. And so written in shaky black ink, as though the writer had been inebriated or in a moving car, according to police, was a message that said, "Police Department, we found this at the beach Thursday night."
They wrote it on the purse?
Yeah. Like, on the purse.
Imagine, like, if they did find the owner of the purse, and then you're like...
Thanks for defacing my bag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Great job.
Yeah. So, they found it on the beach the night that Mimi disappeared.
Okay.
So, despite the fact there's no water damage to the purse, nor sand found on the purse, investigators began combing the beach using lifeguards to look for Mimi. A team of 20 investigators was handling just the search to find leads on the purse.
Okay.
So while all that is happening, a different story about Mimi in her life is starting to unfold. At the time of her disappearance, most of her friends knew that Mimi had her house for sale. It was listed for $65,000, but it wasn't moving. And though Fred was her realtor, friends were worrying that she was showing the house or allowing people in to view it. They were particularly worried because she was there alone without the staff, so they had that same concern that you had. It made them recall a woman named Gladys Kern, a realtor who had been lured into a house and then killed by a supposed client. And could something similar have happened to Mimi?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that's one of the fears that realtors have today, right?
Yes.
So Stella herself had assumed that the meetings that Mimi was having, that she canceled and said she was going to have on Thursday night, were about the sale of the house. And though her gardener, Mimi did have a gardener, was there twice a week, he said that he had seen a man parked nearby in an expensive convertible, but many thought this could just have been someone who was interested in the property. Others were more suspicious of this person.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I know when I bought my house, I just, like, drove by a ton of times.
And... yeah. I mean, how many times, like, when you're house hunting, do you, like, even park outside a house and look at
it? You're like, yeah. What is it? Right?
Yeah. So he was there twice, though, that week?
So he goes to her house twice a week.
Oh, the gardener goes twice a week. Okay, so the man, have we only seen him once at this point?
He said he saw him a few times in the weeks before Mimi's disappearance.
Okay.
Now, on August 26th, which is 8 days after her disappearance, police were alerted to the fact that a watch Mimi owned was at the Beverly Loan Company, a pawn shop in Beverly Hills. This watch featured 127 diamonds and was quite valuable. Now, Mimi always wore a lot of jewelry, like I said, about $25,000 worth.
Wow. And,
yeah.
Especially because she's selling her house for, what, $65,000?
Uh-huh.
Yikes.
Yeah. And she frequently wore the same pieces, and these were not in the home.
So her stuff is being found, like, all over the place.
Right. And so when they find this watch, I'm sure a lot of people thought that it had been stolen and then brought to this pawn shop. But police soon learned from the owner, Julius Zimmelman, is that Mimi had come into his establishment all the way back on July 8th. He said that when she was in, she revealed that she was in a bit of financial difficulty and needed a loan of $100. And she took the watch from her wrist and just kind of plopped it on the counter in front of him.
Okay.
He said that when she did, he was astonished to see a massive diamond solitaire on her ring finger. He said that in his opinion, it could be somewhere in the range of about 7 carats. And so he offered her $5,000 in cash for it, which she turned down. Mimi did say this ring was heavily insured, and so he joked and said, oh, well, you wouldn't put much of a fight if someone tried to take it from you. And she said, no, I guess not. And then she kind of smiled. She did add that she might be back soon, apparently, alluding to the fact that, you know, she might have to sell the ring.
But he was like, if somebody takes it, would you fight? Like...
because it was so heavily insured,
But, oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
So weird.
Now Stella, who, dear friend that she was, she staunchly denied Mimi was in financial trouble, but that did not bear weight as the police dug in further. We know that about a year before her disappearance, she started trying to sell that big game collection she had. Melville Lincoln, who is the curator of the Habitat Groups for the Los Angeles County Museum, said that he had met with her the year before to talk to her about that collection. And he brought the museum director with him. Melville said when they arrived, her car was out front running, but that no one answered the door. He said just as they were about to leave, she appeared, still dressed for an evening out, and said she'd been out late and was having trouble getting started that morning. So it really seems like, I'm guessing what he's implying is like, she stumbled into her house and just left her car
running
out front. Yeah.
So there's just so many things being said, like, about, like, the state of the house or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Because I thought when everybody else went, like, everything was, like, perfect.
Right. So that's what her friends are saying.
Right? Yeah.
Now, this is a year before.
Yeah, it's a year before. But, I mean, it just seems like she was an orderly from the other instances, not somebody who would just, like, stumble in, leaving their car running. Like, yeah.
Now, he said when he met with her, she made very clear that she was anxious to sell the collection. And she said, you know, basically she needed the influx of cash. And also, too, that a man from Oakland and his wife were interested in buying her house, but they wouldn't move forward until the collection was removed from the home. So they were probably like,
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, ultimately, they were unable to purchase it because most of the collection was skins or heads, and they were looking for full mounts.
Okay.
Well, it's going to go in those habitat displays, right?
Yeah, I guess so. And you wouldn't want just, like...
A head.
A head or the skin. Yeah.
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 Now, John Schleicher, who's a taxidermist, had also looked at this collection and had offered just $4,000, which she turned down. He said ultimately the collection was very valuable, but the resale value of it was low because most people just wanted to display animals that they had hunted themselves.
Yeah. Did I tell you about, side story, when I used to babysit the kid that his parents owned the zoo?
No.
So when the animals would die there, they would have them turned into rugs.
Oh.
So like going around this kid's house, I'm like, oh my gosh, there's just like all these animals everywhere. And he was like telling me what they died of.
Oh God.
He's like, that one, like, yeah, that one just like got sick and died. Yeah. So it's just like not a single one was hunted, but.
Yeah.
It was still very like, yikes for me as a teenager.
Well, yeah, I can see that. Like, yeah. Like, actually, I was watching this, like, taxidermist competition, and apparently, like, people were wondering where they get the animals from, and apparently mm-hmm. it's, like, a lot of zoos that are, like, offloading their deceased animals.
Yeah, cause, yeah. I mean, really, if you think about it, where does that end up? So, yes, zookeepers' homes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we know.
We know.
So, the week of her disappearance, though, funds are getting tight for Mimi. That week, she had gone to her mortgage company and asked for, essentially, a $5,000 equity loan. Ultimately, they did approve it, but the approval letter arrived in her mailbox after she disappeared. She'd also borrowed $200 from a friend and placed it in her bank account. This had brought her total up to $209, but at the time she disappeared, it was back down to $9.
Okay, but it's funny because she still didn't want to sell that ring, though. And that would have given her $5,000, and that's what she's trying to get as, like, this home equity loan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So despite all these like pieces of evidence about financial distress, like Mimi's not making kind of the best choices here. She keeps living lavishly. That week she attended a dinner party. She hosted her own barbecue at her house for 14 guests. She'd gone shopping.
So she's still living the life.
Yes. Now, one of her friends said that Mimi told them she was selling her house so that she could buy into a small furniture business, likely because Novice had been working to start one at the time of his death, and she was hoping this would allow her to have additional income from this business. What seems more likely, though, is that, like, looking at the state of her finances, that she might have just been, like, scraping by, mm-hmm. even if she had sold her house. In fact, 6 weeks after her disappearance, the courts were asked to declare Mimi deceased so that the estate could be kept afloat. Like, they needed to pay the bills, basically.
Okay.
And so that her family could regain custody of that watch at the pawn shop. The pawn shop was not releasing it because...
She's gone.
She's, yeah.
Does she have kids? Like,
no. So this is her family, her sister.
Her sister wants the watch.
Yeah, they want her belongings back, right?
Okay.
So, that to be clear, the watch was being held for Mimi to come back and reclaim it. It was not actually for sale.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Because that's a lot of how often pawn shops work. They'll
hold it.
And if you don't come back, then it can go for sale, right? Now, for a brief moment, a judge granted this request to declare her dead, but then had to go back on it when he realized that the police had not indicated that she was dead and that the statute was for 7 years to have passed before this could happen, right? Now, this blip between being legally dead and, well, not, was long enough for her family to secure that watch. Eventually, though, Mimi would be declared dead in 1956. They were able to move forward with closing some of her affairs before then. Her house was sold, likely at a pretty hefty discount, for just $40,820. John Schleicher, the taxidermist, ended up getting her taxidermy collection for $4,500. Hmm. They actually had difficulty removing the elephant from the room because it seemed that the room was actually built around it. And later, Schleicher would actually have to negotiate with lawyers when he found out that the elephant's tusks that he had been assured were real ivory were actually an ivory powder mixed with plaster. And, like, it's unclear when this switch occurred, but it happened.
So somebody, like, sold off the tusks?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know if it was in, like, Novice's era or what, Mimi on her own, but yeah. Now, eventually the collection itself would be sold at auction. By the time Mimi was declared dead in 1956, her estate had dwindled to just $36,000. This was held in trust for a few more years before it was divided amongst her siblings. Now, in the early years of her disappearance, Mimi became sort of a joke or a punchline. Like when a football team lost a bunch of games, the papers said their wins were disappearing like Mimi Boomhauer.
Those were awful times, right? Like, yeah. Imagine doing something like that now.
I bet those jokes still exist.
I bet they do, but yeah. It just doesn't seem okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like to many, which included her family and friends, and also to us listening today, like her disappearance is like this ongoing mystery, right? Mm-hmm. Now, my mom's current theory, when I told her about Mimi, because I talk through these episodes well before we make it to here, is her theory is that Mimi and Navis are spies.
It's kind of fun. Has anybody else said that same theory? No, that's uniquely your mom's.
My mom's. Well, but also there hasn't been reporting about like the ongoing lies in their life, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I think
like the French accent and the inventing
and then the yeah. So I think
wealthier than we are.
You know, kind of add that stuff in, things seem a little bit more like
likely that it could be
like what is going on?
Yeah, what is going on?
Now, one of the primary theories is Mimi was kidnapped, mm-hmm. and some proof of this is that she had these meetings with men. Like, basically, who knows who she could have run into, who could have been invited into her home. Now, some of her friends said that the lights being left on, I don't even know how they draw this conclusion, the lights being left on was a signal that she was being kidnapped.
I don't understand what that means. Like, she turned it on as a signal? Like, I'm being kidnapped, I'm going to turn on the lights.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I mean, I turn on lights every day without being kidnapped.
Right.
We all do.
Now, basically, there was a private agency called the Bel Air Patrol that did circle around Bel Air at night. They were armed guards hired by private families to protect the neighborhood. And some of Mimi's direct neighbors employed them. They said that they didn't see anything suspicious in the neighborhood that night. And they were also just like not weirded out by Mimi leaving her lights on. Their thoughts on it was that it's not unusual in this area of Bel Air. There had been robberies, and the wealthy residents would often leave their lights on when they left to make it look like someone was still home. And it's really true. There had been some pretty bold robberies in the neighborhood in the years that Mimi and Navis had lived there. In 1935, George Hormel, who is delightfully referred to as a tinned meat tycoon.
The Hormel.
Yeah. I love it. Like in tinned the papers. Tinned meat tycoon. They're like the tinned meat tycoon.
Oh my gosh.
He had $5,000 worth of security stolen from his home, which is at 639, so just down the way from Mimi. And he and his family would sometimes actually have to leave the home due to kidnapping threats.
That's pretty crazy.
Right?
Yeah.
And in 1939, Frank Woods, who was at 916, he had his home robbed of $25,000 in jewelry. Huh. Now, there's a man who committed these robberies and he was caught before Mimi disappeared. But, like, this isn't exactly a crime-free neighborhood. I mean, they have, like, armed patrols up there, right? It's because these homes were often targets for robberies. Now, a friend did say that Mimi was fearless and felt she was not inclined in general to take precautions against such robberies herself.
The woman who lives alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
With $25,000 of jewelry herself.
Just like that she wears like on the daily.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another guess was that Mimi had been murdered by the same person responsible for the disappearance of Jean Spangler.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Yes. And we talked about this because we did an in-depth episode on two episodes on Jean. But basically the thing that binds them together is the fact that both of their purses were found.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
They did lead very different lives.
Very different.
Yes. So, but it's like Jean's purse was found. Mimi's purse was found. Therefore, they must be the same.
Right. Different age groups, different
Yeah.
lifestyles.
Different neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then there's this idea that she might have secretly married or eloped. Like, in his first interviews with the newspapers, her business manager, Carl, had said that he hoped she had run away to get married. He refused to elaborate on that. And then William Marco, her furrier, because of course, Mimi had a furrier, said that Mimi had come in to look at furs and that he overheard her say, "I can't give you an order right now because I'll have to talk it over with my present husband."
Wow. Okay.
And he thought, that's weird because I thought she was a widow.
Mm-hmm.
But then she corrected herself and said, "I'll talk it over with my family and we'll come back."
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever mistakenly said present husband.
Right.
When I go to say family.
Yeah, but also,
it's so oddly specific.
I think you should start referring to Jason as your present husband.
It's so fun, isn't it? Because yes. It makes it sound like there's been others.
Right.
Or but there, like, will be others.
But the, like, also,
presently.
Like, even if someone's, like, been widowed and remarried, they don't say, like, my present husband.
Right. It also sounds very temporary. So, like, if you get into an argument, you could be like, says you my present husband. Right. Yeah.
Now. But there's no evidence that we've seen thus far that it is true. But I don't know. Mimi's got a lot going on. Okay. There are others, though, who believe that she ran away to get away from it all.
Which, but would she run away and, like leave all of her
stuff?
Her house, her everything? Like,
yeah. Anyway. Yeah. I mean, what is interesting is when they talk about her getting away from it all, like, I would think it's like, oh, hey, these pressing financial issues, it's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently her friends think it's like her overpacked, like, social schedule.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Like, she's so social, she just needs to, like,
oh, she needs a break from socializing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But when he is interviewed years later, her friend Fred, that man she was supposed to go on a date with that Friday,
mm-hmm.
he said, yeah, he did realize that she was having trouble keeping up with her standard of living. And that when he saw her at a dinner party on the Tuesday before she disappeared, she seemed like she was under, in his words, heavy nervous strain. That's a change from the other people who said earlier that she seemed happy and full of joy at this party. In fact, we do know she even bought multiple sets of holiday cards at the party. But Fred says, hey, the police did find some travel pamphlets in her things for a health resort in Mexico, which is, like, really all the evidence he needs mm-hmm. to say she's just run away for her
mental health,
right? Now, some of her friends do believe that she might have died from suicide and that her purse actually was found on the beach and that she died in the ocean.
That sounds like it could make sense as well.
Yeah.
Especially with the financial stuff.
Yeah. And there's a few more fringe theories.
Okay.
One is that she had some sort of amnesic episode. Like, we talked about this a little when we did our episode on Lola Celi, who also went missing in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
That it was kind of the rage when people disappeared to, like, say it was amnesia. And, like, I don't know, if anyone wants to hire me to write a piece on amnesia and missingness in the 1940s, like, I would love to.
Yeah.
Yeah. But my favorite is perhaps the most outlandish, and it's the taxidermist story, which, to be clear, does have racist overtones and undertones. So I guess it's my favorite in, like, how absurd it is. Not
overtones and undertones? So the tones are just all the way through?
The tones are,
so it's just steeped. Flat out racist.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So he says, basically, Novice and Mimi were in Nairobi in 1929. And he has pictures and maps to prove it.
Okay.
The taxidermist does. And they convinced some Maasai guides to bring them to Marsabe, which is, he says, this is the taxidermist, was a forbidden area of Africa, which is not true. Like, people have inhabited that area for centuries. And if we're talking about, like, British colonial rule, yes, the British were even there, like, messing up everyone's lives by dividing countries and putting borders up. Anyway, now, he says that the Boomhauers shot an elephant while they were on this trip.
Okay.
Presumably the one that he had, that had been in their house. And it caused a scandal because the residents of the region didn't want them to take it. And neither did the British government, who ended up just charging them thousands of dollars for killing it and exporting it.
Okay.
Anyway, the taxidermist guy says the Boomhauers were cursed by a, and this is his words, part-time witch doctor.
Okay. So when they were in Africa, they shot this elephant. There was a argument over it, and a part-time witch doctor.
Yes, I love the specificity.
Here. Not even a full-time one.
But a part-time. Part-time.
Okay.
They were cursed.
Cursed. Okay.
That is why Novice died young.
Okay, but he was actually 65. Yeah. Which, I mean, is still young.
Right, but he...
But yeah. In those standards, in those days, yeah, okay.
Right, and that's also why Mimi disappeared.
20 years after the fact.
I mean, it just, maybe...
It was a slow burning curse.
Yeah, maybe the part-timeness.
The part-timeness set it back.
Right.
Yeah.
Full-time. Full-time,
5 years maybe?
Full-time curse-giving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's really impossible to say what might have happened to Mimi. We already know from our episode on Jean Spangler that the police were slammed in a grand jury hearing in 1950 for their inability to clear cases by solving them. And Mimi's disappearance is one of them. That doesn't improve 6 years later when Evelyn Throsby, who we discussed this summer in a different episode, she went missing. So they were never able to locate her body.
So the idea now of like even finding what happened to Mimi is just very improbable, right? Like yeah. It'll never, this is always going to remain this mystery.
Yeah, it's highly
with
likely
all of this these will. Different theories.
Yeah.
I feel like, yeah.
Yeah. And it just doesn't feel like this will have a resolution at some point. And kind of like one of the investigators on the case, he sums it up best. He says, Mrs. Boomhauer must have had more friends than anybody else in the world. We've questioned about 75 so far, and they all have different ideas about what happened. Some say suicide. Some say it was foul play. Some say she ran away to get married. Some say she was kidnapped. Stir them up and take your pick.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, In the Hills, about Mimi Boomhauer, 54, missing since August 18th, 1949, from Los Angeles, California. Read by Amber Dawn Fox. Amber is an actress based in the Southeast. She travels all around the U.S. and beyond for work. She can be seen on Peacock TV, Hulu, Discovery Plus, Investigation Discovery, Oxygen Network, AMC, Amazon Prime, and more. Although best known for portraying Officer Bellow on The Walking Dead, Amber has gone on to star in television, commercials, and many feature films.
From New York, I watch your house, stream light through its arched windows on a computer screen at my desk, a dream you never knew to have. But they still stalk your halls. Heels clicking on the tile you picked out, and talk about original features, erasing you from the story. The camera pans across your courtyard and we all lean in, imagine parties we would have, nights of drinks and laughter, forgetting all the gatherings you orchestrated under those trees. The party's papers said couldn't be missed. They don't share how you built a room around an elephant or that your husband died in this house, young, they said then, forgotten, now. I look at your house online, trying to find you there. The room of trophies, the safe you could fit inside, the place you stepped out into the night. But instead, there's a drawing made to show what the house would look like if someone would just tear the whole thing down. But for us, it ends like this. Porch lights on, and the city beneath your hilltop mansion, restless like an animal.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.